Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Geeta Kapoor. She's a local young woman now, but she is a civil rights lawyer and also has experience in criminal defense. But right now, we're going to talk about her important new book. It's got a long title, but remember this, To Drink from the Well. And then the subtitle is The Struggle for Racial Equality at the Nation's Oldest Public University. And guess what that is? Of course, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This book is a look at the university's history, really from its beginning through the lens of the of racism, which of course was a part of its founding, and we'd have to confess that it's still there. But the great story that Geeta, you have written is mostly the 20th century, but you do go into the very beginnings. What's the beginning of racism at the University of North Carolina? Think of it when I see the mural at the post office of the laying of the cornerstone.
Well, first, let me say I'm very honored to be on your show. Thank you. I've watched you for years, and I still can't believe I'm here with the D.G. Martin.
You can stop that.
So, well, from the very beginning, when the trustees decided on the location for the university, that's when racism began. The land was donated by rich white men who presumably were slaveholders. That land was owned by Native Americans originally who had been driven off the land. So the very land that UNC sits on today was property of Native American people. So racism began before the university was, before the trustee selected the site. And continued on. I'd say the most pivotal moment in my mind, which I think is what you're referring to, there's a mural in the post office showing General William Davey, who was considered the university's founding father, laying the cornerstone. Well, the way I frame it in my book is that something more than just a cornerstone ceremony transpired that day. He laid down the foundation of the university, laid down what the values of the university would be at the moment that he put the cornerstone down. The foundation that he stood on was 2 feet of brick. That's what the
Masonic or the
right. Well, it's what the builder wanted. And every one of those bricks was made by enslaved men on the site. And I had to learn a lot of things to write this book. And I went and researched how bricks are actually made. And it's a very lengthy process. It requires 24-hour supervision. So he's standing on this foundation that has been built by enslaved people, and there's not an enslaved person in sight. They were not invited to the ceremony. What's really interesting is Davey himself was a slaveholder, and in the recent past, before he laid down the cornerstone, he had sold a young girl named Dina, and sold a man named Joe. So while he laid down that cornerstone, he cemented in the university's foundation the values of racism, white supremacy, and racial inequality.
It reflected the views of the white ruling class at that time. I mean, there was nothing. I'm arguing with you a little bit, but this was nothing all that special in the context of the way the South was. It was a racist society, and any college or state university building or would be infused with the racism of the society. And if you agree with that, it's hard to know whether or not you want to be especially hard on the University of North Carolina with that racist heritage, or you put it in the context of, unfortunately, this is the way it was back then.
Well, it was the way it was back then. But we now look back on the institution of slavery, and I don't think anyone can study all the horrific things that happened during slavery and say that that was politically the correct thing to do, and certainly not the morally correct thing to do. So, yes, it was part of the times to have enslaved people and to exploit them and not pay them for their labor and mistreat them, but that's wrong.
Well, we say that's wrong now. And is it an infection that the university can never escape or pay a lot of reparations or apologies? People at the university now who come from all over the world and all different kinds of backgrounds, most of whom don't know anything about North Carolina. And is your book tarring all of them, everybody, something they can't escape?
Well, I don't think my book tars the University of North Carolina. I think what my book does is it presents the full picture of who UNC really is. There have been a number of books that I looked through and studied during my research that were written by white people, and almost all of them painted the university as a rosy place. You know, the old well is pictured always with the pink azaleas in full bloom. That is part of the story of the University of North Carolina. And, you know, let me be clear. I love that school. You know, I consider myself to be a daughter of that university.
Well, you went to undergraduate and to law school. So you were there for 7 years, as long as most people.
And then I taught there as an adjunct professor. I teach part-time as an adjunct professor. I teach a course on race and the law. So,
well, this is an unfair question, but when did you start feeling uncomfortable with the racist background of the university? From the day you stepped into the university, did it keep you from having a good experience there? Or how did that work for you?
Well, W.E.B. Du Bois described it this way, that being black in America requires a duality of perspectives, of identity. So, you know, there's the identity that you have within yourself, maybe behind closed doors, and then there's an identity that you have out in public. So I would describe my experience that way. What's interesting, and I did not realize this until after my book was published, my first year at Carolina was in 1995, and when I was admitted, I was a resident alien. And I got naturalized.
From Kenya.
Yes, yeah. From Kenya.
So you were a foreign student for a while.
But well, I had been here.
Only you lived in the United States, but you had not become a citizen.
Correct. So I became a naturalized citizen while I was at Carolina. I did not feel like I belonged at the university.
Oh, really?
No. In fact, my mother, like a lot of mothers of color, told me that, you know, you are a minority, you stand out, people are going to be watching you twice as hard, and you always have to be on your guard.
So you had that, your mama's warning on your shoulders for 7 years while you were at Carolina.
Yes.
And were there any happy moments for you at Carolina?
Well, there were a lot of happy moments at Carolina. Carolina is where I learned so much that became formative of the woman that I am today. My first One of my first classes was with Dr. Charlene Register, who I love. We still have a relationship to this day. She taught me a course on slavery. Now, I had never learned the depths of slavery. So, you know, learning that, while it was painful, it was good because I needed to know the truth about this nation. While I was at Carolina, one of the highlights of my social life, six other women and I founded a multicultural sorority, Theta Nu Xi, and it's now all over the nation.
You're kidding, really?
No, yes.
And are you still participating as an alumnus, alumni?
Well, we're considered, the seven of us are considered founders. I do participate. I need to participate
yeah.
more.
No, I mean, and this is, you know, a difference, I think, at least in, on the male side, between black fraternities and white ones is that, and I think for, it's my impression, sororities as well, is that it means, well, it means a lot throughout your life. Take, for instance, our vice president of the United States, who, when she started her first campaign, was embraced by black women all across the country because they were sorority sisters.
Yes. Yeah. She had access to the Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you got to discipline me. I'm getting off subject. There's some other interesting things, but let's take a break and then come back and talk some more about your book.
Okay.
If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Geeta Kapoor and talking about her new book, To Drink from the Well, The Struggle for Racial Equality at the Nation's Oldest Public University. She and I will be right back. Welcome back to Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with Geeta Kapoor and talking about her provocative, disturbing, wonderful new book called To Drink from the Well. The subtitle is The Struggle for Racial Equality at the Nation's Oldest Public University. And it is a wonderful story, but we can't talk about it without talking about some uncomfortable. We want to talk about it, but we don't like to be uncomfortable.
Well,
so you got that problem in dealing with me, Geeta.
Well, but if what the university did, as you said earlier, was a byproduct of the times, I don't know why people would be uncomfortable with the true story.
Well, we could say, I mean, we all the white defenders of the university, we always go back to Frank Graham and say, well, he was really working for us to be, he was proud of what the university was, but he knew that there was a problem and he was working to correct it. And that would be where many of us white people would want to be. That people would say, well, they were stuck in that framework, but they worked to make it better.
Well, let me first say this. There's no reason at all for any person who is white or Caucasian to be defensive after reading my book. I don't want that. In fact, what I want is to expose the university's history to light so that we can move forward towards restoration and healing. And I'd like to come back to one of your other questions that you asked me about the university, whether or not it's in a cycle that it will never get out of. As long as the truth remains hidden, and as long as the university is not willing, as it has been for very long, to confront the stories that are in my book, the truth that's in my book, the university will continue to be stuck in a system of systemic racism. Systemic racism replicates itself. I mean, and this is what I mean by that. The Board of Governors for the university is predominantly white men. At this point, it's conservative white men. But to be fair, even during times where the board was controlled by Democrats, the cycle of systemic racism still played out. The cycle is this, that, you know, the university makes wrong decisions, immoral decisions. Let's take, for example, the recent episode with Nicole Hannah-Jones. They, you know, they denied her tenure, in effect, by not bringing her tenure to the committee. But in effect, it was a denial. They denied her tenure, and then they were forced to do the right thing. They were forced. If we look throughout the university's history, all of the gains that were made by African American people were because the university was forced to do it, either by legal struggle, by national exposure, or massive protest. So it's only after the university gets exposed nationally that people, you know, and the university is condemned and everyone's, you know, gasping, how could this happen at UNC? It's only then that the Board of Governors rescinded their decision and granted her tenure. And that cycle, that's the cycle of systemic racism, where the university only does the right thing when it's forced to do it. That's a cycle of systemic racism, in my opinion, that will continue to replicate itself. And what needs to happen at the university, the director, I believe the director of the athletic program, and I may be getting this wrong, but he's one of the administrators in the athletic program. After the horrific murder of George Floyd in Minnesota, the horrific police murder, said that he didn't understand why racism still exists. Well, the News and Observer wrote this scathing article condemning what he said, in effect saying that, you know, racism, there are individual acts of racism, and then there's systemic racism, which means that racism is embedded in the laws, the policies, the regulations, power distribution. If we look at the University of North Carolina, those who are in power are predominantly white people, and that needs to change. And that can change if the university has the courage to change. So it's not too late for the university, for the university administrators to chart a different course for the University of North Carolina in the next two centuries.
I do want to talk to you some more about that, because I've got some different feelings, but I want to talk about your book. And so we talked, it's such a great book, and
thank
there's so many
so much.
Things which I think support. Which offer support to your feeling about how systemic racism, as it related to the years that the university has been in existence, doing some really good things for lots of people, but infected with a white supremacist institution. And dealing with that and seeing, I guess it's easy to say, well, we can accept that, that's factual. But when you deal with the stories of how that worked on different people's lives, as you do in your book, it's inescapable. Talk about our friend Winston.
Wilson.
Wilson, yeah.
Caldwell. Well, Wilson Swain Caldwell. It's interesting that you asked me when racism began. No one else has asked me that. I wrote this book because I came across two black and white photographs in the Wilson Library. One was of the first two African-American students at the law school, and then one was of the first three undergraduate students actually seated at the old well. And I went looking for their stories because I didn't know that history. And I was very stunned. I felt betrayed. I come from a long heritage where the tradition is to honor elders. And, you know, these men had opened the doors for me and for many other people of color. We didn't know who they were. So I went looking for the court cases. And then I went looking for their stories. And then I started digging in the university's history. Really in archives all over the place. And I wondered exactly what you asked me. When did this all begin? And how am I going to begin this book? Immediately after that, I went back to the Wilson Library to continue digging through the archives. And I got off the elevator, went in the clear glass doors, and I saw a picture of a black man perched on a canvas. It's a very grainy, old picture. He had a very sad look on his face. And I connected with him in a very strong way. I felt like he wanted me to tell his story.
Well, and he was an enslaved person.
Yes.
Tell us about what he did as a slave at the university.
Yes. So he was an enslaved person. And the moment I saw his picture, I knew that was the beginning. So I went looking for his story, and I actually went to his grave in the university's cemetery, the black section of the cemetery.
Can you find it? Is it a marked stone there?
There's a marker on the street, and it's distinctly identifiable from the white section. The white section is very well kept.
Right, but I mean, is the individual...
Wilson Caldwell's grave, yes, has a sandstone marker there.
So I can go out and see that name.
Yes.
Which I probably will do now. You've got me all going.
Yes.
So he's buried there, and he was a slave. But what would our ancestors have said, our white ancestors have said, he was a very special person. He was a dear friend of mine. I mean, he got along with. He was subservient, but he got along with the white people. They loved him, I guess.
Well, they had no choice, really, but to love him. He followed in his father's footsteps. His father had been enslaved by the president, the first president of the university, Reverend Caldwell. And as a part of his duties, as a part of Wilson Caldwell's duties as a slave, he had to get water from the old well, because back then the university did not have water. That was the only water source. He had to build fires in the dormitories of Old East and Old West. He had to wait on professors, wait on students. He had a whole, you know, slew of duties. He also took it upon himself, interestingly enough, to discipline the students. And they seemed to receive it well, perhaps because he knew all their stories of, you know, they would put a cow in a south building, or, you know, they would drink alcohol on campus. He would catch them. So there's that relationship. But when we really look at Wilson Swain Caldwell, he was owned by Governor David Larry Swain, who was also the university president. When we look at his life, he had 11 children. And as I sat there at his grave, I wondered what dreams he had for himself and what dreams he had for his children. Certainly, I know they certainly were not, that they would be enslaved and that they would follow in his footsteps the way he had followed in his father's footsteps.
I love this. I love this story. We've got a time problem, but later on in your book, you describe how he became, after the Civil War, for a time, a justice of the peace.
Yes.
And he was able to, we would say, boss white people around a little bit, but that the became the object of the Ku Klux Klan and the when things changed again, so that the white supremacists took charge again, he lost that job.
He did lose it. In fact, Governor Holden, William Holden, once he got into office, he was a Republican, not Republican as we know it today. That was the Liberal Party back then. He appointed a number of black people to public officials, to become public officials. Wilson Swain Caldwell was appointed as a justice of the peace. But I don't know so much that he was bossing white people.
Well, he had a position of authority.
He did have a position of authority.
For a very
short time.
Gita Kapoor, I've gone over time. We're going to have to take a quick break. If you joined us late, we're talking about her book, To Drink from the Well, The Struggle for Racial Equality at the Nation's Oldest Public University. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Geeta Kapoor, and she is talking about her brand new book. It's called To Drink from the Well, and then there's a subtitle, The Struggle for Racial Equality at the Nation's Oldest Public University. Geeta Kapoor, thank you again for coming. Is that struggle ongoing?
The Nicole Hannah Jones episode shows us that the struggle is ongoing. The removal of Silent Sam and the backdoor deal that the Board of Governors engaged in with the Sons of the Confederacy shows us that the struggle is not over. The fact that they made the deal and they thought they could get away with it.
What's left to do? The struggle in the struggle for equality. What if you were? We hired you as a consultant and said, "Okay, we've found out that we are still struggling to bring about racial equality. What? How would you counsel the leaders of the university to arrive at a place where equality has been achieved? What would you order?"
Well. First, I would tell the administrators that they needed to do a very in-depth assessment, and it needed to be done by a third party in terms of, you know, which departments are receiving more money than others, which departments have more African American people than others, how many tenured professors are there that are Black. Who holds the positions of power? Right, who's the chair of these departments? So I would require them to do a very in-depth assessment of the current state of the university, including the racial demographics of everyone who has power, who has the power to make decisions at the university. After that assessment, then I think the university would need to accept that truth. First, you can't make any changes, and this is true even for our own lives. You cannot change unless you accept the truth. And so the university would have to accept that truth, and then people would have to be willing to give up their positions. If we are to become the society that we say we are on paper, as Dr. King said, there has to be a redistribution of power. And that needs to happen at the University of North Carolina.
Well, let's look at it from a different perspective. I look at your book, and it's a description of a long struggle towards equality. Various things happen. People mostly African-American students and lawyers push the university to change, and that the change, looking back at it, many people who oppose those changes would agree that they've strengthened the university.
Absolutely.
You think about what the university would have been like without in the athletic field without Michael Jordan,
right?
Or people like that who
right. Or the scientist who invented the Moderna vaccine, right? Who now UNC has a international reputation of being an institution of that's a research powerhouse. So, yeah, what would it be like without those people?
In your mind, does the university have the reputation of being throughout of being? As it did in the 1910s, 20s, 30s, and 40s when it was absolutely a white racist, but it had a reputation of being maybe the most progressive university, at least in the South, and competitive. Do you think the university has that reputation now?
Well, the university in large part, what my book covers is that I don't think has been covered before is how the university developed that reputation. And it was largely during the 30s by Frank Porter Graham. He had a very close relationship with Franklin Delano Roosevelt and was appointed to multiple federal committees that exposed the University of North Carolina to that exposed the University of North Carolina everywhere he went. For example, he studied the dynamic of federal funding to state schools. Back then, they didn't have it. So he went to, I believe it's 27 states, and every time they introduced him as the president of the University of North Carolina. So here he is espousing ideals of the government needs to provide funding to states. That was a very liberal idea. He was a fierce defender of academic freedom. So it's during his tenure, which was very long, that the university rose to have this this reputation as being one of progressive, even not just liberal, being progressive and one where academic freedom was greatly valued. I'm sorry, I forgot your question.
No, I think we'll take a break and we'll get that question through. I know you're doing great. If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Geeta Kapoor. We're talking about her book, To Drink from the Well, The Struggle for Racial Equality at the Nation's Oldest Public University. And she and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm visiting with Geeta Kapoor. She's the author of a new book that's called To Drink from the Well, The Struggle for Racial Equality at the Nation's Oldest Public University. And Geeta Kapoor, thanks for coming in. Of course, the oldest public university is University of North Carolina.
Yes.
What have we missed?
Well, I think you asked me what was the most surprising thing I discovered in my research. In 1895, the university provided electricity to the town of Chapel Hill and the Carrboro areas. Mm. But the black communities in Chapel Hill did not have electricity. The university also provided water to its campus and to Chapel Hill. UNC piped in water from its intake area through the black community. Then it was treated at a plant at the university, and then it was pumped back out to campus and pumped back out to the white business district and white neighborhoods in Chapel Hill. Black people living in Chapel Hill had 22 wells that were deemed polluted. A study found that the wells were polluted. They were without sewer. As well, they were without sewage and had to use 140. They had 144 outhouses. This is probably the most troubling thing that I found. I can't get past, having an image of black children running through these markedly inferior neighborhoods, not having access to water. How do you deprive another human being of water, of clean water? I will never be able to get past that. In my mind, that's egregious.
Well, there are still struggles with water and sewer in Chapel Hill. I mean, in recent times, there have been other aspects in which people would believe that there have been racial
exclusion?
In terms of the making available water and sewer services.
Well, as recently as 2010, according to a Chapel Hill native, Danita Mason Hogans, there were some neighborhoods in the black community that were without water and electricity until 2010. So that's very troubling.
I would say to you, if you go throughout the South and find similar examples, so you'd say, well, that doesn't make it any better.
No.
But it does, it puts in context that the that I might not have been as surprised as you were that these municipal like services that the university somehow or another was providing were not extended to African American communities.
Well, the problem is that the University of North Carolina is the nation's oldest public university. And as the nation's oldest public university, it's seen as a leader. And it sets an example. So the decisions that were made, the policy decisions that were made, such as denying Black people water, denying Black people entrance to the law school, denying Black people entrance to the undergraduate college, those set an example, not just for the South, but for the nation, because the University of North Carolina, again, has this reputation as being very liberal. You asked me earlier if it still has that reputation. Absolutely, because when the Nicole Hannah Jones crisis happened, people all over the nation were gasping and saying, how could this happen? This is UNC. This is the most liberal school. But that image of being liberal is somewhat problematic, in my opinion. There's another part to the story, and that's the story that's in my book.
Well, got lots of other things that we need to read your book about, and we should read the book about. It is not just a history of racism. It's a history of the – and it's not just history of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. It's history of – particularly of our region, of our country, of how we did things. And as I told you before we got started, if I just read your book, three years ago, I could have saved a lot of reading time because you taught me things that I've learned in other books that I've had to read.
I'd
recommend the book as for someone who just is interested in the history of our region and our times, and particularly if you're interested in Carolina.
Well, particularly if you're interested in this idea of racial reckoning. Right. We find ourselves in a moment after the death of George Floyd where people are very open now to understanding how that happened, how he was murdered, how the police officer thought he would murder him and get away with it, obviously. Why else would he do it? But I do want to add one thing. Someone pointed out to me that, and this is something I'd never thought about, that my book is not just about the ugly things at the university or the ugly things in North Carolina or even in the nation, because my book does cover some of the struggles that the nation had for racial equality. But it's a beautiful story because it shows the determination and the courage of Black people. They never passively accepted their position. They knew in their souls that they were human. And they knew that they were entitled to what everyone else had because they believed in God. And God created everyone in his image. So this is also a story of people who faced every conceivable odd and who kept fighting. And it just blew my mind when I read about how Thurgood Marshall fought case after case after case. You know, as a lawyer, I've taken cases to the North Carolina Supreme Court. I can't imagine the kind of work, the time, and the effort it takes to get a case to the U.S. Supreme Court, and then to do it repeatedly, almost, you know, within months. So my book is also a very beautiful story.
It really is. As a lawyer, I'm amazed at what those lawyers accomplished and how committed they were to this. I wish we had the time to talk about some of the I'll just mention that you talk in your book about some of the characters who've been important in North Carolina history who rose up out of the struggle for the legal struggle for the admittance of Black students to Carolina. And, one of them was I. Beverly Lake, who later on became a candidate for governor and became a representative for conservative white people. But he got his start on the cases trying to keep Black people from going to heaven, being able to go.
As an assistant attorney general. Yes, yeah. He did. In fact, he argued the state's position on how desegregation should be implemented to the U.S. Supreme Court. That argument is in my book.
You got so many other things in your book. Thanks for
Thank you so much.
We knew we would not be able to cover it, but it's been so wonderful to talk to you. Thank you for your great book and for being willing to spend some time with us.
And thank you for all that you've done over your great, great career.
So nice. Well, our guest has been Geeta Gapur, who is the author of To Drink from the Well, The Struggle for Racial Equality of the Nation's Oldest Public University. A great book.
Thank you so much. Such an honor to meet you.
Thanks to her, and thanks to all y'all for listening, and I'll be back here before you know it.